Good morning and welcome to our meeting. It is now 9:00 on September 19th, 2023, and time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County Community Board of Commissioners. I'm Rebecca Wolf, President of the Commission. Present today are these PUD officers, Sid Logan, Vice President, Commissioner Sid Logan, Vice President, Commissioner Tony Olson, Secretary, Christie Sterling, Chief Information Officer, Colin Willenrock, General Counsel, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerk. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices. This session is for the Board and CEO, General Manager, to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with PUD staff. Chief Information Officer Christie Sterling will now facilitate the discussion under the CEO, General Manager's briefing and study session. Welcome, Christie.
Thank you, Commissioner. Happy to be here this morning facilitating, and we have a busy agenda today. So we'll jump in and get started. First, we have a presentation on the education program overview from Jenny Lamarca.
Hello. I'm just going to make sure.
Jenny?
Will I be able to move the PowerPoint? Can you hear me?
This is a great way to start our meeting. This is a wonderful program.
Good morning, Jenny. Yes, you should be able to use your arrow keys to click through the presentation.
It's not letting me.
Click on that front page. Try now.
Oh, now it will. Let me go back. I just wanted to make sure that everything was set before we started. Thanks for having me today. Many of you know me. My name is Jenny Lamarca, and I'm the Education Programs Coordinator. Unfortunately, with my health issues, I can't be in person today, but luckily Krista took this recent picture of me to make it a little more personable. I recently hit my 15th year anniversary working at this position, and I still can't believe that I've worked here this long because I'm really passionate still about all the work that I'm do. And I'm excited to share with you today what our education program has been up to. I also wanted to recognize Heather Herbst, as she's been my job share partner for the past 5 years, and it definitely takes a full team to make this all happen. And I know we're already in the 23-24 school year, but I first wanted to look back and share with you what we've accomplished last year, as it was a huge year getting all of our programs back in person out in schools. It was our first year back after COVID. Last year for classroom presentations, this is where we take teachers and go out to schools for energy lessons. We offered 6 elementary lessons for 3rd through 5th grade and 2 middle school workshops. We taught 1,170 lessons for a total of 26,494 student hours of instruction, which is incredible. It's always fun totaling it up and seeing the big number. We have such a small water service area, but we still offer a water program to our water schools, and it's a storytelling program with Wanda Flipple Fairy for grades kindergarten through first. And last year we taught 59 lessons and reached over 1,000 students. I just have a quote down here from one of our evals from a teacher. We obviously have a ton of them, but I thought this one captured so many things of what we do. And within the lessons, just as the PUD is working on our DEI efforts, We're focused on inclusion even more when we visit classrooms. Classrooms are becoming more diverse, more wide range of abilities, a lot of English language learners. So a few things that we have done. The first picture here that says circuit systems, that's one of the classes that we offer. We're really focusing on what are the learning targets and letting the students know what those targets are so they know exactly where the lesson is going. And it's also an introduction to vocabulary. In the center aisle, those are forms of energy cards in the National or Next Generation Science Standards. The forms of energy are huge in how looking at energy systems and how energy is transferred and transformed within systems. So these are cards that kids can lay out around a circuit, or they can use the pictures to help them remember the forms of energy. And then this energy choices game ticket, it's a conservation game we play. We used to have it, it was a bookmark that the students wrote out their goal of how they were going to save energy. And what we realized is it was a bookmark and it had lines. Well, there's a lot of students who, when you ask them to write something, their body language, they just, they struggle with writing and they just kind of turn off their brain. So we made it more fun that it's a ticket and they can either draw or write their ideas so that all students can be successful and make choices with Jenny, how they want to share.
Commissioner Logan, I have a quick question for you on that slide. So, you know, one of the challenges I think we have with adults understanding is that electricity is created, used at the same instant, other than if it's stored, you've got chemical energy on your thing. Is that something that we're able to help these third through fifth graders understand?
So at like the third through fifth level, it's very basic. And these are the forms of energy and words of how they're listed in the standards. So when they get into middle school, they get into potential and kinetic, but how we focus on chemical energy is just within a battery. And if the students were building a circuit, what we have them look at is how is energy transferred and transformed. So at this very basic level with a battery, there's chemicals in that battery and it's stored chemical energy. And we don't actually say stored, but chemical energy is then when a circuit is built, it's transformed into electrical energy, which transfers along a wire. And say it's a light bulb, then that energy is transformed into light and heat in the light bulb or the output device. And then whatever energy is left is that still electrical energy that transfers back to the battery.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question? So they're really having the students analyze, you know, this is, I think, my third or fourth rendition of standards since I've worked at the PUD. And it used to be kids identifying what is a circuit, what is a closed circuit. Now it's really looking at systems and analyzing a system. What are the inputs? What are the outputs? How's that energy moving in that system? And I think ultimately it's getting kids realizing that whole grand idea that energy is never created or destroyed. It's only transferred and transformed in systems.
Right. Thank you.
And Jenny, this is Commissioner Wolf. I think what's one thing that's interesting to me is instead of they've moved in the standards from identifying what is to showing their understanding. I can explain, I can describe, I can describe.
Absolutely.
So showing and their understanding, as in math. Now, they're not just giving the answers, they have to explain how they got there.
Absolutely. And some of these big questions, and then they have this huge question and they do all these things to try and answer that big overarching question. And absolutely. And these forms of energy cards are nice because I'll get to it in a little bit, but we do a teacher workshop and the teachers get a copy of the PowerPoint and they have these forms of energy cards that students could take a picture of something on and then with the computer cut and paste or copy and paste all these forms of energy to be able to explain it in that way. And it is that explaining, not just a right or wrong answer. It's the depth of the knowledge. And we continue to do our Meet the Renewables assembly, which was so great to be able to do last year since we hadn't done it in person since the start of COVID. And during COVID, we took the time to redo the backdrops. I think they were 10 plus years old and were kind of getting weathered. And this way is actually makes it more compact and they're a little more artistic. So it was great to be able to take the assembly out on the road. Here you can see Sunny Solar and Hydro, and they're teaching about solar panels and solar energy. We did 15 assemblies for almost 3,000 students last year. And one thing on the classroom presentations, as well as the assembly, we provide teachers with what we call follow-up guides, and they have questions or activities so that teachers can continue what they learned when we were there with them, so that we leave even a stronger impact.
That's great.
And like I mentioned before, we do many virtual teacher workshops, and it's great to be able to do them virtually because our service area is quite large and teachers' time is valuable. So it's been something that's great that's come out of COVID. We did two last year. One was paper circuits and one was solar bugs. We work with a company that makes these kits and tailors them to what we need. Teachers who attend the workshops receive a class set of supplies, and classes have gotten so big, I've even had to add in more when teachers contact me. Last year, we mailed out 87 class sets of kits, and we always ask for teachers to send us pictures back so you can see students working on the solar bugs. And then the paper circuits are great. They can build circuits, and the tape it's a conductive tape that's fabulous to work with. In the lower left, it's showing a parallel circuit, but it's neat because I don't know if you can see that paper flap, but it actually acts as the switch for it. And there's limitless things that teachers can do with this, but on the bottom right, that a teacher sent, they make gingerbread houses and they lit up the paths to their gingerbread houses this last year. So teachers are craving hands-on, and every teacher who's gotten these supplies from us have been extra appreciative. And once again, during that workshop portion of it, I'm instructing them on, you know, those forms of energy cards and tying all of these projects back to the standards and providing them with a lot of resources. And I left this in here just because we did it last year, but you all were there celebrating our contest winners last year. Community events, we continue to do more and more outreach in our community as people are contacting us for support, and it's something we love to participate in. We are a big part of the Energy Block Party last year. Heather went through all of her hundreds of kits super fast, so that was exciting. In the middle, we've got STEM, or some schools call them STEAM nights, that they host and invite us to. And once again, this just every year continues to grow more and more. It's a great way to reach kids of all ages. And we talk to a lot of adults as well, as their parents are there. Good way to teach about energy hands-on to all grade levels. And then the one on the right, Heather, this summer was invited to a foundation for Edmond School District, and it was a almost summer camp type thing. And she took a few coworkers and they went and taught. It was a game about renewable energy, really hands-on and active, kind of running around game. And this is one of the things I'm most excited about, because I think this leaves the biggest impact, our field trips. Last year, we did 9 field trips to Woods Creek and the microgrid. At Woods Creek, anyway, we've worked it out. So we divide students into smaller groups. And so they learn from different employees and then we rotate them through. So they're in smaller groups. We've had anything. The one picture with the waterfall is a Cub Scout troop. They have certain requirements they need to do for their different badges. And then we've had all the way up to, I think, Everett Community College students. And one thing I just love is that, you know, there's kids out there, but once again, we're getting the adult chaperones as well. And it just, in my heart, I used to always say this at teacher workshops too. I feel like every citizen should see how electricity is generated to understand the complexity of the process, as well as having more appreciation for when they plug something in. And Woods Creek is so valuable in that way because it's got the environmental side as well and all the work that we're doing. And we get fisheries biologists out there as well. We hope to be able to do more in the future. And a big shout out for sure to the generation group. They're willing, engaged, and they have been a dream to work with. And also then for the microgrid, Scott Gibson and Nick Peretti. Hopefully the microgrid, that one's tricky with all the construction going on, but I'm super excited for when we've got that demo that we're working with the county grant with out there. I think it's going to be amazing. I'm super excited. And now, finally, looking forward to this school year that's just kicking off. We've got 1 new teacher and 5 returning teachers to get out to schools and teach lessons. It's always a little bit of a slow start. A few weeks, teachers wait to get their classroom routines and everything set up and good behavior before they want to invite a guest in. But we are ready. One thing Heather and I worked on this summer is updating our Journey of Hydropower lesson. A big part of it is a PowerPoint with real pictures of Jackson. But I think over COVID, the whole PowerPoint, kids were almost saw too many PowerPoints. So we kind of shortened that PowerPoint up. We got feedback to make it more hands-on. They've always used a hand crank generator to build a circuit with that lesson, but we brought back some things that we've done in the past where, like a rope, and you take this big rope, and when you put the ends together and make a circle in the classroom, it shows exactly how big the penstock is for Jackson, so they can visualize how much water is moving through there. And even a simple bathtub toy demonstration, because hydropower is very similar to how we, you know, a bathtub toy, that simple concept. We're hoping to do more field trips this year. And this career card game, and I sent to the commission office a set of the game for all of you. It's really neat. We were just invited to do it. NREL and Aquarium, they must have won some grant, but it's a renewable energy game. And we have 4 employees who are on this slide. Those are the 4 cards for the game. And basically, you're trying to get a set of 4 of similar groupings, and they're all they're all renewable energy careers. So it's really neat. You get exposed to a lot. And even me, I just going through all the various cards, learned some things. So we're always trying to get careers, ways to show students the vast energy careers that are available out there. So it's fun. It's a very inexpensive game. We just paid printing that we're hoping to pass out to lots of different, you know, middle school classes, some AVID classes, career counselors. And then one more thing, we keep doing this more and more, is getting more PUD employees involved. Our education program is a great way employees can get involved for community engagement. I always say if one person, you know, everyone just did one little thing every year, it'd make a huge impact. And what I really like about it more now is people can just zoom into a classroom, you know, for 30 minutes versus if I would ask someone for a guest speaker request before, they might have to drive an hour, check in at the office, you know, do it and then get back to work. So, or we've even had employees out in the field just zoom in and show something that they're doing out in the field. I feel like the PUD has passionate employees and they just really are inspiring to students. So that is super exciting. I've already gotten a request this year for someone. Their curriculum was on ecosystem restoration, but it was the whole curriculum is on a rainforest and she wanted to bring it close to home. So Haleon Generation is going to zoom in with them and talk about the projects she's done.
Excuse me. I think that's fantastic. And I don't know if you've thought about it, but maybe you could invite the commissioners, you know, one at a time to get involved along with the, I mean, some of these activities would be very appropriate for us.
Oh, I would love it. Yeah.
No, I think, you know, if we're asked, we are likely to respond.
Okay, that's great to know.
Commissioner Logan, are you interested in this?
You know, if it's beneficial to the program, I'm sure.
That would be my response, yeah. Only if staff feels it's beneficial
staff
to the program.
Ours.
Right. I'm not saying no. I don't want staff to think, oh, we've got to include a commissioner. It would only be as appropriate.
Well, I still appreciate your help last year with that group that we brought in on that app that they built. I mean, that was a life-changing experience for that group of girls. I still am inspired by them in that whole presentation. So that was how you guys can help as well.
Yeah,
wasn't
that great?
It was wonderful.
This is Commissioner Olson, and I have a comment in, well, I'm just in awe of Jenny of what you've accomplished and with your team and where you started from in our education program and where we are today. The sophistication of it is commendable. And also, given my past experience, the incredible work that's done on the design, the programming, the think tank that you must have, resources, but the complexity of delivering this into the schools, scheduling, delivering, it is very, very difficult on top of everything else. So I truly commend you and your team.
I'm hoping Heather is on. I'm sure she's listening in too, because scheduling is a bugger. But then when we get the evals back and or go out and see, you know, when you're in schools, it really makes it all worth it.
Well, I'm glad you said it is scheduling, because it is very difficult. And I hear you and I commend you. I just wanted to say that I think it's a fantastic program, and I think it's a great use of our investment in the community. And in a way, it kind of goes along with our customer service appreciation week, because this is a customer service. Because our schools, our teachers, everyone involved, those are our customers too. So thank you very much.
Customers and hopefully future employees too.
Yes.
Jenny, this is Commissioner Logan. I just wanted to thank you and Heather and your team. It's so wonderful that you guys have found ways to make electricity and water fun and interesting and educational. And I think it is so important right now, as the whole nation goes through a clean energy transformation, people to understand the physics of energy, and it's not too young to start learning. And I too am really excited for the demo unit that you're doing with the county.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for the presentation.
And another thing about water is helping students to understand how our whole nation is suffering from water shortages in many, many places. That kind of goes along with appreciating water.
Absolutely. And I want to thank all of you, I'm sure, on behalf of all teachers, too, who receive these lessons. We all the appreciation back to you for the board's support in our program.
Jenny, thank you so much for the presentation and sharing today all the wonderful education opportunities and presentations that you do. So thank you for the presentation.
Well, thanks for having me.
Great day. All right.
Take care.
Next, we have Maureen Barnes talking about the Snohomish County Interurban Recreational Trail easement.
Good morning. I'm Maureen Barnes, Manager of Real Estate Services. There we go. The purpose of this presentation is to inform the board of the proposed updated 25-year interurban trail easement with Snohomish County, outline the primary terms of the easement, and then the new easement will be brought to commission for a public hearing and approval by resolution at the October 2nd, 2023 commission meeting. Jump right in. So a little bit of background. The trail follows the original Pacific Northwest Traction Company, we refer to it as the PNT, interurban electric train corridor, which ran from Seattle to Everett from 1910 to 1939 and spanned 29 miles. Puget Sound Power and Light Company converted the right-of-way to a power line corridor in 1939, and of course in 1949, the district purchased that electrical system from Puget Sound Power and Light. In the 90s, Snohomish County and the cities of Edmonds, Mel Lake Terrace, Linwood, and Everett built an approximate 12-mile pedestrian and bicycle trail, which connected to the 12 miles of trail that's through King County, starting at the city of Seattle, going up through Shoreline, then into Snohomish County, which is the interurban trail.
Thank you so much for that slide. I was so excited to see that we had an electric train back in the early part of the 20th century.
Kind of everything that's old is new again, so really? Welcome Sound Transit.
Yeah.
So, in light of the many changes, of course, in the previous 25 to 30 years, it was essential that we draft an updated interurban trail to put in place as those former easements expired. In 2018, a new 25-year interurban trail easement was negotiated with the city of Linwood, and the easement was intended to serve as a template easement moving forward with Snohomish County, Mount Lake Terrace, and also Everett. As the initial 25-year term of the easements were approaching expiration dates, we did reach out to secure new easements or, if needed, term extensions to allow for time for negotiation. 2019, Snohomish County declined to enter into a new easement or a term extension of the existing easement, whereas the city of Everett did. So looking at the current one, and you may ask, this easement is the product of significant collaboration, cooperation, and compromise between the county and district staff. And yes, it has taken nearly 4 years to complete. In large part, this has been due to staff turnover, of course, to throw the pandemic in there, and us needing to seek cost sharing for encampment cleanups. Despite the challenges, we were able to reach an agreement on numerous complex issues and craft a reasonable and fair easement agreement that satisfies the requirements of both Snohomish County and the district. Whereas there are some minor changes from the Linwood easement agreement, which was used as the template, moving forward, this one will become the new template with the remaining cities of City and Mount Lake Terrace. Edmonds has a perpetual easement. So the terms. Term again will be 25 years. No changes or modifications to the trail without the district's approval and review. Whereas the trail is a paved portion extending 10 feet on either side of the center line, which the county has been and will continue to maintain, any debris from dumping or transient camping outside of that footprint will be split between the county and the city, the district and the county regarding the cleanup, and it is split 50-50. County will pay the costs associated with any sort of warning signage and/or protective devices. The district will inspect and maintain any fencing or stormwater infrastructure that it installs or has installed upon the property. The county and the district will jointly inspect the trail bi-yearly, and any relocation of the trail or trail amenities is at the sole expense of the county, with the district retaining the right to request relocation as needed for system reliability and safety. And I complete that and would love to take any questions.
I have none. Do you have any commissioners?
Thank you, I do.
Questions or comments?
Well, just when you, let's see, was it the county that in terms of dealing with the protection devices?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the cameras? Are there cameras on the trail?
I don't believe that we have any cameras at this time on the trail. There would be at substations that are just right off of the trail.
All right.
But if there was a need for them, then yes, the county would provide them.
And in terms of your negotiations, have there been any issues with the access of cyclists to the trail?
I don't believe that there has been any problem.
Can you call me in, Edmonds?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any problem.
Okay.
Yes, and in fact, there's, you know, a while back, I know I was here and the question was asked because Snohomish County had put out a press release about doing some changes to the trail. Those were actually the areas that were outside of the trail. And there's a few areas where it actually leaves the PNT right away and goes on to the street.
All right, maybe that's what it was. All right, thank you.
Well, Maureen, you're the closer.
Congratulations.
Thanks. It's a lot of work, I know.
I'm going to take that, but I'm also going to give a special thanks because this was not unilateral and everybody here just did an exemplary job. So thank you very much.
25 years, right?
Yes. Yes, yes. And I know I will not be here when the next one comes.
Well, if you want to go.
Yeah, thank you guys very much.
Thank you, Maureen. All right, next up, we have a presentation on the Public Utility Regulatory Policy Act at Snohomish Public Utility District. And to do that presentation today, we have Christina Lennyweber.
Good morning. Thank you, commissioners. My name is Christina Lennyweber, and I am still a relatively new economist here in our RAIDS Economics and Energy Risk Management. I've been here almost a year now, and previously to that, I worked almost 13 years for Tacoma Power, doing the same kind of thing down south. So I am very glad to be up here and to be speaking to you today on the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act. Right now, today, where's my clicker? There it is. Okay. Right now, today, I will be just giving you some informational briefings on the act. We aren't asking you to do anything today, but you will see at the conclusion of this presentation that we will be asking for some actions from you in the future. So the first point, of course, is what is the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act, more helpfully and easily known as, usually as PURPA. And PURPA is quite a old regulation. It's older than I am. In fact, it's a response to the 1973 energy crisis, which I happily did not live through. But and so it was a federal response to that, designed to encourage a more diverse generation system in the United States. And a lot of things that we really here in the Northwest have been leading at around hydropower, around conservation, and around renewables. Now you might ask, why is the federal government involved here, since we are a public utility and we are owned by our citizens? But the truth is, we do engage in interstate commerce on the power side. We do across the entire Western interconnection, in fact. And so there is some federal oversight of that. Certainly not as much as if we were an investor-owned utility, but it's still there. And fun fact, for those who might question that, the only space that isn't part of that federal regulation is ERCOT, which is the Texas grid. They have purposely sealed themselves off due to their desire not to be federally regulated. And that's one of the reasons they had that big power outage back in 2021. Because when Texas froze, they couldn't bring any energy in. So we trade that little bit of federal regulation for having a lot more reliability for our customers.
So they built a purple wall.
Yes, they built a purple wall. So why are we bringing this? If this has been here from the 70s, why are we talking about it now? Well, because its PURPA is a big regulation. It's been amended a lot of times. It covers a lot of stuff. And it was most recently amended back in 2021 with the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. And this focused on two things that have been, again, stuff that the Northwest has been leading on here, demand response and electrical vehicle charging. And here I'll take one brief slide to remind everyone, EV charging is very simple to understand, I think, but demand response is another of those bigger topics that can have lots of little tentacles reaching out and cover a lot of different things. So from FERC's point of view, from the federal government point of view, demand response is anything where the utility sends a price signal to the customer to respond by reducing energy. And you can do this in a bunch of different ways. You can do this through time of use rates, you can do it through incentive programs, there's a ton of different ways, but anytime you're getting that combination of price changing and the customer responding by reducing load, that's the sort of things that PURPA is thinking about as demand response.
So this is why the board is involved, because mm-hmm. we have to approve whether to decide whether to go with what PURPA is proposing or what we want to do on our own, correct?
Yes, we're clarifying how we are complying with PURPA, right, and what we're doing in these two new spaces,
right,
that the federal government has expanded this act to.
And so these two new items are the only two parts of the new amendment.
Yes. As I said before, PURPA covers a lot of different things, but we've already addressed a bunch of that.
Right.
Since I believe the first board action on PURPA was in like 1981. And so it's been moving on since then. Okay, and so that was a wonderful transition. Thank you, Commissioner Wolf, for what are we doing regarding this legislation. And hopefully you remember from a few weeks ago, we have been working right into that space of demand response through time of use primarily is our first cut of actually getting a demand response program here at the district. We've had a pilot program that has shown that it can work here. And we've baked that into our integrated resource plan and our future plans. And we hope to roll that out with our new AMI meters to the broader customer base to provide an opt-in, not a mandatory, but an opt-in program for the customers who can take advantage of this and get some mutual benefits for the utility. And we hope then in the much further future, once it's rolled out to our largest residential segment, to even go further with it, talk about the commercial industrial segments, talk about different, more complex program designs. But that's of course, first we have to get the meters out, one thing at a time. And then of course, we've been working as well in the electrical vehicle space. We have an electrification of transportation plan. We've baked our EV assumptions into our load forecast and our IRP. We're working on educating the customers, making sure the grid is ready, making sure we have enough electricity for that purpose, and educating our customers about this. So even though the law just recently changed to incorporate these formally on a federal level, we're doing everything, we think at least, that the law would like us to do.
So Christina, a lot of these things are sort of projects we have underway, we haven't finalized any of them. Is there a deadline for compliance, or is we just need to be working towards that goal to satisfy the new purple law?
You are very good at anticipating my slides today, because here we go. Here is our plan of how we plan to comply with the law. It's we believe that we can show that our current programs and our current plan forward in these areas will be sufficient to comply with the law, instead of having a purpose specific rate, the perfect, you know, that's labeled, this is the PURPA rate, this is the PURPA EV charging plan. That what we have in flight will be that, and we will be asking you to look at that in a more formal way in the future, in October, for those purposes, according to the timeline that you see here. And so we will be bringing to you some formal documentation about that. Hopefully, yeah, no, I don't think this is really good, but I'm gonna knock on it anyway on the October 2nd meeting. We also would like everyone to know that we do have a public website where people can submit written comments or ask more questions. The last time we opened, we did, the last time we informed the public about this and did a public comment period was last year, November. I was told, I wasn't here for this, but I was told it was at the beginning of November in 2022. We had, as you will see, from the previous slide, we did have an opportunity of a public meeting a few weeks ago. We didn't really get any responses to that, but it still is there. And we have information on the website so people can read about what we're doing specifically to PURPA in this case, or find links to more information. They can submit written comments there. And do we have now any more questions or comments?
I have a couple. Do you have any questions or comments?
I have no more questions, thank you.
Okay, so apparently we missed the August 31 comment deadline for the public. And I was wondering how that happened, because we never heard about it.
Oh,
that's in the requirements, the government requirements, is that we have to have, they had a 1 month comment. And I'm sure all the comments, if we had had that, we would have a lot of positive, supportive comments. I'm assuming that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine.
Well, what was the public meeting that nobody?
Yeah, I never heard about that.
Which one is that one?
That was a public meeting for internals. So there's public comment on the federal level, as the federal government is like promulgating regulations, and then there's public comment on the internal level. We did some, and I will have to look at the public affairs people. I know the public affairs people did some advertising for the meeting that we did for our internal local public comment for what we as a district are doing. And certainly we've gotten commentary at other meetings that are certainly in this space, but I guess for some reason, the public is just not feeling, just, you know, battening down the doors when they hear Public Utility Regulatory Policy Act.
Well, they have to know about it.
Yeah, so we'll, but certainly that's something that we have taken note of, and we do plan to more vigorously work on that in the future.
So doing a little research, and that's dangerous, right? A little research. I was wondering, there's a part of this that allows us to recover any costs involved in what we do on PURPA. So do you know, can you talk about that at all? Recovering our costs to provide these PURPA events or projects?
Yeah, well, all of our rates and programs that we design are designed to be in the public interest and to ultimately provide some net recovery, whether that's a rate or a program. We're doing it for a reason. We just don't spend money to no end. So if we design our rates from the cost of service, starting with it. If we deviate from that, we deviate it from it, like you say, a low income program or something where it's a different a public good. And so we, you know, and certainly as a public utility, all of our money comes from the public. We don't have a magical pot of investor money like we were an IOU. So that's where a lot of the language in PURPA comes from about recovering or not recovering, because in the investor-owned world, you have to have a pretty bright line between what you recover from the investors and what you recover from the ratepayers. And we don't have any investor money. We're always handling our money in the public trust.
Okay. Maybe that was a sticking point for us, that we are allowed to, I mean, that maybe we didn't want to raise rates that would be ostensibly related to PURPA.
So
we do it internally in the planning and the execution of our projects.
Yeah. So, Commissioner Wolf, just a few points of clarification. I also have Joe Fina, our resident expert. Christina did an excellent job, outstanding background.
Yes.
So just for clarification, the statutory deadline, back to your question, Commissioner Logan, is November 15th. You have to make a formal determination on the record of the appropriateness of those standards and how they will be applied to the district. So that's kind of the deadline. We've not missed the comment period. The comment period is open as part of this process. There will be a public hearing. We do have a website. We are soliciting comments from the public. Will then be utilized to help inform your ultimate decision, which will be on the record. That process is ongoing. I think you're referring to an earlier process that another utility may have used in terms of their comment window. Our comment window is open, and we're still within the deadline when we need to make a final determination.
Oh,
which,
well,
again,
that's good. I'm glad to know that.
November 15th of 2023. So
okay.
We had given a prior presentation prior to my time back in November of last year that said in the fall. So staff has been processing these different standards and the application to our utility with the intent that we'd come back in the fall to present to you a recommendation with the feedback from the public on how this would be applicable to Snohomish Public Utility District.
Thank you. I was under the impression that the August 31 deadline was a federally required comment period.
Yeah, each utility is required to have a hearing and solicit feedback. And that, we are in that process now. And that's what we're using the website for, as well as the hearing.
Okay.
Joe, did you have anything to add? I'm sorry.
Me? Oh, Joe.
Joe Fina.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Colin. Joe Fina from the General Counsel's Office. I would just add that a public notice will be published in the Tomorrow's Herald. And it'll also be posted on our PURPA website detailing how the public can provide comments by on or before October 2nd, which is when the next board meeting is, and when staff is proposing on having a public hearing on the two PURPA considerations. And I'll just emphasize on the rates, you know, side of things. The PURPA rates, if we can call them that, are not a subject to these two, you know, demand response and EV charging considerations. The district dating back to 1981 has a PURPA policy in place that addresses, you know, PURPA rates and how those are calculated, and so that has been, you know, in place for a very long time, and that's the reference document that we use when we receive questions about PURPA rates. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Joe, just jog my memory. Haven't there been other instances where the board considered proposed changes that the utility chose to follow the programs that it had in place? Has that occurred in the past?
Yes, Commissioner Olson.
That's okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've had since 1981, there have been about four other requirements that have come up, and the board most of those times have decided to decline to adopt the PURPA considerations, and I'll just, you know, underline here, you know, what the legal requirement is for the district, and the legal requirement is to consider the proposals and make a determination as to whether to adopt the proposals. Those are the only legal requirements. And I'll just add that the district under Directive 74 has a detailed procedural schedule that we must follow. And you'll start seeing that in its more formal way at our October 2nd meeting, where staff will bring forward a formal recommendation and the public hearing will commence.
Okay, thank you.
It's helpful, thank you.
Excellent presentation. Thank you, Christina. Thank you. Bravo, that was great.
Thank you, Christina. The next presentation is our supply chain update. We have today Clark Langstra and Mark Flurry. There you are, Mark. Sorry, I didn't see you back there.
Good morning, Clark Langstra from Contracts and Purchasing. We've added Mark Owens to the lineup this morning, sort of a last minute addition to address some of the impacts on substation that we're seeing in the supply chain space. Before I start the presentation, I just want to direct you to the picture. This is, you know, common utility equipment, transformers and spools of conductor, but what you can't really see from this picture, if you zoomed out, you'd see that this isn't taking up parking spaces at the operations center, not in the normal storage area on the yard there because of things that we'll discuss later in the presentation. And there are some mitigating factors that we can get into later as well in terms of how we're handling the injury storage requirements. And so like I said, we've added Mark Owens to the lineup today. We were last here April of last year to give you an update at that time on some real emergent issues in supply chain, specifically regarding lead times and pricing. So we're gonna follow sort of the same agenda as we did in April and talk about some of the critical materials that we're seeing, updates on that, impacts to the PUD, and some of the mitigating strategies that we're either continuing to use or that we sort of tweaked our strategies to accommodate things that we've learned in the last year and a half or so regarding supply chain. So in general, the timeline to go back to that first COVID period where we were all going home, our demand to vendors was shutting down, we weren't placing orders, manufacturing plants were shutting down, there were labor shortages. And as those plants came back online, they were discovering that there was sort of this cascading thing where producers of raw materials had shut down and they were unable to get those raw materials. There were raw material shortages that just sort of spread through the entire industry. So we briefed you at that time on how that was impacting us, and one of the resulting mitigating factors, the major mitigating factor at that time, was an emergency declaration that allowed procurement staff to act more quickly when they did find material, not have to use formal bidding procedures, which if we take that time to go out to bid, we may lose that equipment to another utility or another customer. So moving forward from that time last year, like many large utilities across the country, we continue to see increased development, high demand on construction here locally, more large load customers. Electrification places obviously greater demands on construction as well. And then EV production continues to challenge us in terms of competing for things like core steel and chips that are used in some of our equipment as well. And so then as we look ahead, we see continued pricing pressure and lead time uncertainty. And there is a Department of Energy standard for transformer efficiency that's not been firmed up in terms of scheduling, but it will impact how our suppliers build transformers, how much of the raw materials they have to use, and that could result in additional constraints on
increased
those materials.
Cost.
I'm sorry.
What? Increased cost.
Increased cost. Yes, increased cost, and something that's already constrained even more short slide.
On your next slide, I saw some of those numbers and I fell on the floor.
I read that the ABPA is working hard to try to put that down or defeat it.
Yes, absolutely.
Or change it or whatever.
If we can't, if they can't be convinced to not do it, at least push it out to where it doesn't impact. The supply chain as it is now. So getting into some specific materials, we had a couple of slides last year about distribution transformers, and we showed that there had been, just in that last quarter of 2021 going into 2022, an almost 20% increase in a very short period of time on those distribution transformers, which was impacting us from a price standpoint. Price increases have gone down over the last year of our contract with the distribution transformer vendor. We've seen more reasonable single-digit price increases depending on the type of transformer that we're buying. Lead times continue to be a factor. We've had ongoing communication with that supplier in terms of just trying to match our demand with their production schedule so that when they are producing transformers, where they could, the production line was set up to build things that would work for us, we were able to give them input in terms of what transformers were the priority. And so that has helped us to get more transformers in, but we are still really just running right at supply and demand being equal. They're going right out the door, most of them, as they come in. We are working on some alternative suppliers as well, where we can take
supplies off.
What was the lead time?
What was the lead time before going into this mess?
Usually no more than a couple of months, transformers, for distribution transformers. And we very rarely see anything come in less than a year from when we order it now. So we have purchase orders out there from late 2021 where we are still seeing deliveries on those transformers.
I think it's really commendable and amazing that you're still under budget with all of these hikes, price hikes.
I'm not sure we're under budget.
Well, I think we're a couple of $2 or 3 million under the original projected budget. And the last.
Mark, do you want to
talk about
that? That may have changed over the last few days.
I am Mark Owens, Senior Manager of Substation Metering and Telecommunications. Talked a little bit about substation transformers. As you can see, they've gone up significantly in price, over double. They've gone from about a year lead time to now pushing 4 years. We were lucky, our manufacturer that we had a contract with prior had some production slots, and so we utilized the declaration of emergency and capitalized on those production slots. We got more transformers coming in next year, so we're in okay shape, not great, but okay.
Are we still having to buy offshore for those?
Yes, the next purchase, I believe, will be offshore. The ones that we have coming in, like you said, next year, and we have in stock today, we have three on our hard stand at Abbott Ops, a brand new ones right there. Those are all built within the U.S.
Yes, that's right.
Mark, when I look at those price increases percentage-wise compared to the distribution transformers, I mean, it's alarming. Is there price gouging, or a better word for that, or is it different? Is it constructive or labor, or what's the, any thoughts on why the differences?
I believe there's a lot more labor involved and a lot more material involved as well.
Yeah.
So these are, the distribution transformers is what you see in the green boxes at every, all over the place or in the air. These transformers are significantly larger, so there's a lot more. Like any labor, and there's more material involved, so I think everything in general is gone.
But you're wise of having three on. You said you have three new ones on the
three brand new ones sitting in operations right now. And we've got, like I said, several more that will be arriving next year. And then we are using, it's not the declaration of emergency, but it's a different RCW that we're utilizing to purchase more after that. Our standards and our equipment engineer will have the opportunity to do quite a bit of traveling to make sure that those transformers are built to our standards.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I know he's looking for that.
We do very good oversight in that.
Yeah. substation switchgear, not quite as big as increase, but still substantial. And you can see that the lead times have gone from 8 to 10 months to 2 years. And so, you know, when we're looking at new substations, we have to order all this equipment well ahead of needed, well, before this project started. Wrong way, it looks like. There we go. Circuit breakers, same kind of thing. They've almost doubled in price. And they've gone from, the lead times have moved from 10 to 12 months to 2 years.
Wow.
We have a fair amount of those still on stock, and we do a very good job of refurbishing. And if they need to be sent out, the refurbishment process is less expensive and much quicker, so we utilize that as much as possible. Circuit switchers is kind of the same thing, they've gone up significantly, 50,000, and once again gone from a 10-month to 12-month lead time to 2 years.
Are those items that we need a specific brand or model, or I mean, is it proprietary to the company that we're using, or are these things that will connect to our SCADA system where we can operate which brand we buy? Or I'm not asking the question very well. I'm trying to understand if we're sort of selected into one vendor.
So we're not selected into one vendor for the circuit breakers. We can utilize different vendors for that. We do like to have the same vendor in all of in one substation, so we're not going, you know, vendor A, B, and C in that. Circuit switchers, we found that one vendor is significantly better than the rest. And so we really do try to spec it out so we get a good quality circuit switcher. We've had some experiences where we've gotten more quality circuit switchers and had all kinds of problems with them. And we spent a lot more money on labor and repairs than we have on actually buying the circuit switcher. So we really have are pretty selective about that.
Mark, and just to finish off this slide, the commissioners have been well briefed on the delays for the AMI meters, so I won't belabor that point. Others have certainly answered any questions that we had on that. And then I just wanted to say that we've covered a lot of the critical materials that have really been ongoing over the last few years, but in that last bullet point on the slide, there is a little bit of whack-a-mole that goes on in terms of one day suddenly some part that we had good supply and short lead times and predictable pricing will come up. One of our mitigation factors is just to try and better understand our demand and use data to predict and forecast what we're going to need so that doesn't happen, that we get more advanced warning on that given the longer lead times.
Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
So I'm here to speak to impact to the PUD. First and foremost, it's created the need for increased inventory, which of course has increased the need for laydown area. And that first picture showed, you know, ops parking stalls full of transformers and wire reels. So we've needed to find more storage space. And just to tease something we'll be bringing to you for your consideration next month, so we found an area on 80th Street that we can lease for 3 years. And it's just outside the East Gate, so just up the road, in a great location. So you'll see a presentation on that and presented for your consideration in the month of October.
Have I been
on that? Yeah, no, it was very fortuitous. So the current value of our inventory is about $54 million, so you can see that's up just about double where it was in 2019. That's caused the need for increased costs, and then, of course, depletes our cash reserves. So that's an impact for consideration. Also, the potential, I'm not saying we're going to see problems with storm season this year, but there certainly is the potential for reduced reliability if we don't have overhead transformers and wire and cross arms and poles on hand for storm season. And we're feeling really comfortable about our position going into storm season this year, but it's something that we're constantly thinking about and prepping well in advance to get ready for it.
Well, I saw this page, you know, not like everything. I mean, I know there are impacts, particularly on carrying your inventory, the cost of carrying your inventory. but it has to be done. You know, yeah, but on the other side of the coin, the cost of the customer and utility is, I think, 10 or 15 times more than this. So I have seen some of your, what do you call them? They're not PWCs, they're material and supply purchases. And it looks like that you're doing maybe even multiple years.
We are.
And I thought that that was probably because of dealing with this issue.
Yeah, and you'll see on a follow-on slide, we really don't see any end in sight or light at the end of the tunnel. Yeah. We expect this to continue through 2024 and 2025.
You know, I only go to ops for safety days, and I was thrilled this year. There was no parking. And we had the inventory, it was so obviously so much greater.
We've yet to turn any developer away. We've had just a huge influx of development.
Yeah. Yeah. So for the concept of just-in-time inventory, which was a huge, huge thing.
It was a big thing a number of years ago. Yeah, but you can't do that.
Yeah, those days are gone for sure.
You have a job to do.
Yeah.
And I don't care if apartment is street.
I agree. I'm glad we're doing that. I'm really proud of us for doing this.
Another impact to consider is staffing strategies and Clark just spoke to Connect Up, and I know you get regular briefings, but on the meter reading wind down and the Connect Up meter installation wind up, there's certainly been an impact with the delay in the AMI meters there, something to think about as well. And then finally, impacts to our customer needs. As I mentioned, we've met all the demands of customers and developers, but we've certainly had to partner with them. There's been delays in construction. Sometimes they have to have multiple mobilizations with their contractor to come back and set it. Transformer as we issue it to them just in time, just to ensure that we keep sufficient stock. So they've been great partners in this supply chain crisis.
And one of the contracts that we're going to be voting on this afternoon has to do with a residential electrician to go out and
do repairs
on meters before they're installed and as they're installed and maybe after they're installed.
It's for the bases, for the new meters as we put those in. If there's substandard meters as part of our program, we're going to be working with our customers to get those brought up to standards.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you.
So to speak to mitigation strategies, under the umbrella of proactive procurement of materials, as you alluded to, Commissioner Olson, we've been looking at different sources of supply. In fact, under the emergency declaration, we're looking at two separate vendors actively pursuing a contract, which was supply us with some single phase pad mounts in the first quarter next year. I'm really excited about that. We've also participated at much smaller volume in mutual aid with our peers, and through LPPC, NWPPA, and APPA. So it's been great to reach out and work with our peers and trade materials as needed. We've also extended our planning windows to broaden orders and assess stock. So that means that we're looking much further ahead. As soon as a development comes in the door, we're already looking what the potential materials are, inputting that demand into SAP, which will be reflected in the system, and generating the need for those POs to go out. Increasing stock levels to accommodate longer lead times, I've spoke to that already, and ordering larger quantities earlier than normal, which necessitates the laydown area. And finally, increased communication and coordination with not just suppliers, but customers as well. We've let them know where we're at. They've met us in the middle, as I mentioned. And lastly, staying financially healthy and maintaining those cash reserves in anticipation of impacts like those pad mount transformer contracts we expect to see in Q1 of next year. Art mentioned improved use of data. We now have a dashboard that the material procurement team uses to look ahead, and it has kind of a green light, yellow light, red light approach on materials. Catches your eye, then we can start that procurement process earlier than we would otherwise. We use that also to identify storm stock, which we set aside above and beyond what we normally need for our development activities, and have that in reserve for storm season, which is just around the corner. And then also just a great cross-functional team across the district with folks from Scott Jones' team, folks from Guy's team, all working together and collaborating on how to address this crisis. So the outlook, as I mentioned, we expect these supply chain disruptions to continue at least through 2025. And we've talked a lot about pad mount transformers. there really is no end in sight to the core steel issue. That is going to take years to stand up additional core steel development in North America. We did work with Kim Schreier's office here recently. She testified on the floor to try to delay that transformer efficiency. Well, looks like that might be successful in delaying that 3 or 4 years, but we're not going to get a lot of progress made in generating additional core steel manufacturing in just 3 or 4 years. Emergency declaration is still actively being used, but we are giving priority to competitively bid where practical. Then lastly, just continuing to closely monitor material inventory and demand, ensure materials are available to accommodate planned and unplanned work, customer growth, and then storm restoration. So with that, I'll answer any questions you have.
Any questions, Commissioner Wilson?
No questions. I can talk about this stuff forever, but I have a question.
You know, just a comment or concern. I can imagine, you know, what we've covered from the pandemic and that, you know, that supply will open up, but at the same time, you know, the entire nation, the world focusing on electrification. Mm-hmm. We have auto manufacturers focusing on electric vehicles. So, you know, really, unless there's increased manufacturing capacity, it seems like we might be in a situation for a very long time.
I agree. I'm encouraged that there seems to be a good awareness in DC of the problem. There's been lots of discussion around it, so that encourages me.
I have no further questions or comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Commissioner Wolf, can we take a short break?
Okay, until 10:15. Please be back by 10:15. It is now 10:15, and we are resuming our meeting. And now,
it is my turn. Thank you. The next presentation this afternoon is Snow Plowing Reliability 2022 with David Hodge.
Ready to start it?
Yeah, I'm not the only one that's late. Council is late too.
Go ahead, David.
All right. Thank you for having me. My name is Dave Popich, and I will be presenting our 2022 reliability data. Please feel free to stop me at any point with questions. A few common reliability index definitions that will be used throughout this presentation are SAIDI, the total duration of interruption for the average customer; ADI, the average time to restore service to a customer who is experiencing an outage; SAIFI, how often the average customer experiences a sustained outage; and a major event day, where SAIDI in a 24-hour threshold exceeds, or when SAIDI in a 24-hour period exceeds the threshold. This threshold is calculated annually using an IEEE method. Number changes slightly each year based on the previous 5-year data. Taking a look at our 2022 reliability data compared to 2021 and the 5-year average, we like to exclude major event days and planned outages to focus on typical day-to-day operation. In 2022, we had a small decrease in SAIDI, while KD increased by roughly 13 minutes. This means that although we had slightly less outages, the outages that did occur were more time consuming to repair and restore. When looking at SAIFI, the average customer experienced 1.14 outages, which is a decrease from 2021, but slightly above the 5-year average. Utilities report their numbers annually to the Energy Information Administration. In the following table, we have our 3-year data compared to Puget Sound Energy and Avista. Looking at the data while excluding major event days, we averaged the lowest SAIDI and KD in the 3 years, but the highest SAIFI. The major event days in 2022 affected us greatly more than the other two utilities. In the next slide, we'll look at those major event days. Unrelated to reliability, but a positive for us, you can see that our number of customers continue to grow annually. When including major event days and planned outages, our 2022 system SAIDI was 1,004 minutes. For a day to be considered major event day in 2022, the threshold was a SAIDI of 13 minutes. We had 8 days that crossed that threshold, the worst being by far on November 4th, the first day of our once run. That single major event day accounted for 529 minutes of our total. So this means the average customer experienced almost 9 hours of interruption on that day. The graph here breaks down SAIDI into four categories: 0 to 0.5 minutes, 0.5 to 1 minute, 1 to 5 minutes, and 5 and above minutes. On the left y-axis, we have the total SAIDI minutes by those days. And on the right y-axis, we have the number of days that were in that category. We see we had 296 days that were between 0 and 0.5, and that only totaled to 30.3 minutes of SAIDI. We had only 12 days that were in the 5 and above category, but that totaled to almost 900 minutes of SAIDI. This data shows that our total SAIDI for the year is heavily affected by a small percentage of outlier days.
I have a quick question about that last slide. So does a short event, like when we have some kind of automated recloser, you know, so it powers out for maybe 30 seconds, does that trigger a safety event?
It does not. So the threshold when we declare an outage is 1 minute. So an operation like a breaker reclosing or a recloser closing would be well below that 1 minute.
Great, thank you.
The last few years, we've looked at certain substations or circuits that have contributed far more than others to our total system SAIDI. Last year, we found a fairly normal contribution from our substations and circuits. But this year, we see that gold bar, a circuit or a substation with only 2 circuits compared to our normal of 4, contributed to 18% of our total system SAIDI. Expanding more on SAIDI outliers, we looked at circuit lengths compared to SAIDI and drew a best fit line, which is the average or expected performance of any given circuit. Of our top 5 outliers, both gold bar circuits are in there, which means they are performing worse than expected for a circuit of its length. Both gold bar circuits were severely affected during an ice storm late in the year. Conditions made it hard for crews to perform restoration efforts. Majority of these outage causes were tree related. 12-554, which is number 1 on our list, had its feeder tree trimmed in 2021. Might be expected that this feeder would see a great improvement after that, but that is not the case. Here's a Google Street View of 2 spans that are standard for gold bar 554, with 100 foot plus tall trees paralleling our distribution lines. The area we tree trimmed in 2021 is highlighted in yellow. This is as high as we go per our standard for distribution and tree trim. When looking at the rest of the circuit, the rest of the circuits that we tree trimmed in 2021, all but this gold bar circuit and another greatly improved in SAIDI for 2022. But without completely removing the trees, the potential of a tree-related outage is still there. So our data supports that this tree trimming improves reliability on our normal and blue sky days, but it may have less of a benefit during wind events or snow and ice events like the one we experienced in Colfar. In 2022, 42% of our outages were tree related, which contributed to 63% of our total system SAIDI. Comparing that to 2021, we actually decreased by 10%. This year. Historically, the low 60s is where we've seen our contribution by tree outages for SAIDI. So it was good to see that kind of got back to where we normally are, and that maybe 2021 is most likely a outlier. Our reliability improvement list included mostly new circuits this year. All of these circuits will be reviewed for potential projects. Continuing with Gold Bar 554, which had 91 outages, we faced some challenges on potential improvements. Like other circuits that are commonly on this list, Gold Bar 554 already has 3 reclosers. So the benefit of adding additional reclosers decreases drastically, but the cost stays the same. System planning protection is looking at other potential reliability improvements that we could do for these circuits, one of which would be undergrounding portions of the feeder. Northbound 2515 is also on the list. This one returned higher on the list this year after we completed two reliability projects in early 2022. We're at the end of the trim cycle for this circuit, so that is going to be one of our next efforts for that circuit. Clearview 587 currently has a project in progress for a new recloser and multiple projects for mitigating conductor slap, which were some of the outages that occurred. And then South Camino and Granite Falls are reliability specific projects put in to target more switching opportunities for ECC, which I'll talk about in later slides.
So go back to that slide. When I look at the slide, I was really astonished at the 2020 and some of the 2020 safeties. That's a tremendous number of outages. And those same ones don't appear in 2022. Is that a surprise? Is that because of like portage? Did something happen between 21 and 22? Or is 19, the safety of 19 is just so large?
Yeah.
Trying to understand.
There was nothing specifically that was done at Portage 3503. That's part of the challenges with this is circuit will come up, have a really bad year, and then we don't see it for 5 years.
So I know we had one of the storms we had ice building up in the lines out past Granite Falls, and you know they'd repair the lines and the lines would come back down again. Did those count as multiple events, or because they're all part of a storm, they counted differently?
If power is turned back on and then it came back down, then those were multiple events. All those reliability projects are created using what we call our unspecified project list. This list has been greatly improved in the last few years to prioritize projects by score, which is determined by the type of projects, the reason for it, and the potential improvements it can bring. In 2022, we installed 11 reclosers. We've done 10 so far in 2023, and we have a big wave of reclosers being released here right before storm season starts. We completed 19 unspecified projects, which included conductor spacers, regulators, capacitor banks, fuse installations and replacements to further isolate outages, and new tie and isolation switches for more potential switching opportunities. We had 318 miles tree trimmed in 2022, which has become more challenging in the last few years. We've seen increased contract cost, which has caused bidding delays. Customers became less responsive to our notifying during COVID, which has remained. And in the future, we will see budget deferral effects on our amount of tree trimming we can do. The unspecified project list isn't just for reliability projects. It's also used for protection projects, capacity projects, reconfiguring, can be used for safety, and much more. All of those also improve reliability in some sort of way. Year after year, switching is one of our most effective ways to reduce outage minutes for our customers. We had 352 outages that benefited from switching in 2022. Outage minutes reduced from a potential 59 million customer minutes interrupted CMI down to 32 million CMI for those 352 outages. This year, one number that really stood out is that 46%. We were able to reduce our total outage minutes by 46%, which is an increase by 10% when looking at the average of the last 3 years. So our system operators are seeing improvements at each year of how much they're reducing outages.
That's a tremendous improvement.
Yes. So going back to those South Camino and Grant Fall projects, we're putting in switches for more opportunities for system operators. We're hoping to see some results next year from those switches that we've put in. So currently the switching is done manually out in the field per direction of our system operators. As we bring communication to these protection devices, we'll be capable of doing that switching remotely, which is going to shave time off of driving out and doing it manually, or opening and closing devices manually.
What about the projects out on Camino Island? Is that when those are completed, is that going to help with all of these measures?
So those South Camino and Grand Fall projects were specific to creating more opportunities for system operators to do switching. Uh-huh. And as of now, every recloser that we release, we add the capability for future remote controlling. So eventually, yes, they will be able to remotely control. In 2022, there were 114 outages that benefit from reclosers. Outage minutes reduced from a potential 55 million CMI down to 34 million for those 114 outages. For reclosers, we will reduce our total outage minutes by 38%. System plan protection will continue to target circuits and locations where reclosers provide potential benefits.
So a recloser is that an automatic device, as a switch is a manual device?
A recloser is an automatic device. It will detect a fault, open, and reclose after 5 seconds. If the fault is still there, it will trip and lock out, while a switch has to be remotely or manually opened. We continue to implement auto-sectionalizing auto-transfer schemes for our transmission level. In 2022, there were 114, automatic switching schemes operated during 17 transmission outages. 10 of those were the result of temporary faults. In the remaining 5 of the 7 permanent, CMI was reduced by the automatic switching schemes. We upgraded and added 6 schemes in 2022. We're planning to do 7 in 2023, which most of those are already done. It's hard to quantify the improvements that these schemes bring, because it would have to be assumed how long it would take to manually perform that switching. On a blue sky day, that might be a couple of minutes, but during a storm when outages are coming in every minute, the auto part of this is essential, because any given transmission line can have up to 2 to 3 substations on it, and any substation can have 5 to 10,000 customers on it. So every single minute there that we save is very important.
I have a question on this slide. Installation or retrofitting automatic switching capabilities, I would assume, is a multi-year project, right?
They're just year projects that they're not even actually a year though to implement.
Well, I guess I'm referring to the wrong thing, yeah, because we are upgrading.
On the transmission level, we've been doing automatic switching for years now. On the distribution level,
okay.
Moving on to future plans, we have now 12 recloser panels that are communicating through the Sensus network out in the field. They will soon be SCADA tested, which will give our system operators the opportunity to remotely control them. We're planning to do 12 more in 2024. We now have 3 single phase reclosers out in the field, which we are testing, and by Q1 of 2024, we'll decide to move forward with one of those. Deploying these single phase reclosers is a critical part of our fire mitigation plan. The Sandwood to Camino 115 kV transmission line is currently being built. The North Camino Ring Bus will improve the reliability of the island in the case that an event takes down the existing transmission line. Sky Valley, a double bank substation, is now live. A ring bus will be completed in 2024 for Sky Valley, which will allow for automatic switching of the transmission. And Woods Creek will get an auto sectionalizing scheme along with that project. And then last but not least, we're reevaluating different reliability improvements methods, such as undergrounding. By acquiring costs and lifespans of overhead and underground equipment, and outage costs over time of different equipment and locations, gives us another tool to justify new projects for reliability. Any questions?
I'm so ignorant about, what is a ring bus?
A ring bus is basically a how do you explain a rainbow? It's multiple ways to switch our transmission. So in the event of overloading even or outages, it's multiple ways to reconfigure how we are feeding our transmission. And again, the transmission outages are very impactful to our customers.
So they're important.
They're very.
Okay, thank you.
I don't have a question, but I have a comment. You know, I live in North County and I interact with a lot of our customers. You know, I'm in North County. I think they sort of just take outages as a fact, but they're always really interested when they hear about some of these technologies that we're implementing, reclosers and those kinds of things. And I have said to people, well, you've ever had an outage that lasts just a few seconds, lights come on. They say, oh yeah. I said, well, that's because of the work we're doing. And so I'm really proud that, that we're, I mean, it's hard, especially in rural areas, to make big investments in reliability, but I appreciate it.
That's great progress. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, David. All right. Last but not least, we have Bonneville Power Administration Cost Adjustment for Marie Morrison is here to present.
Marie, I remember when we were virtual, I always saw a bicycle on the wall behind you.
I miss that.
No worries. Very good to have you here. Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. Marie Morrison, Principal Utility Analyst, Power Supply. Good to be with you today. My co-presenter is Christina Liney Weber. You heard PURPA from her. And today we're going to talk about the Bonneville Power Administration cost adjustment for fiscal year 2024 and 2025. So today is just an informational briefing to the commission. There's no ask of the commission for today. In terms of the agenda, we'll talk first about BPA's final record of decision for BB24 rates. And then Christina will refresh the commission's memory on how we do about the BPA cost adjustment or the BPA pass-through. And then we'll wrap it up with next steps. So on July 28th of this year, BPA published the final record of decision for rates that will take effect from October 2024 through September 2025. And we heard that the BPA administrator decided to keep average tier one rates flat. But we also know that individual customers' rates would vary depending on the products and services they purchase from BPA. For the district, as a block and slice customer, the district is subject to small increases across our power and transmission products. In your included in your packet is an appendix that would show the steps on how we calculate the BPA pass-through. I'll pause for a moment here and see if commissioners have questions.
I have a quick question. So if tier one rates remain flat overall, does that mean the low volume customers have essentially had no or increase in block and slice customers? Is that how it panned out?
Yeah. So for low volume customers, the rates are essentially flat. But for block and slice block customers, the rates would vary, like I said, depending on their tier one cost allocator, their TOPA share. So that was really short for me. I'll turn it over to Christina.
Thank you, commissioners.
It's good to see you again. And I will be walking through what is our standard practice for when BPA changes rates, because this is not the first time that BPA has increased our rates. And the commission and the commission's predecessors have already thought about this and have already included in our rate schedules
the language enabling the district to pass through these BPA rate increases when they occur. Now, there has been a little bit of a deviation from the usual course of events in that the federal fiscal year starts, or at least BPA's federal fiscal year, I don't know if it's the whole federal government, starts in October, but they, but with this process, it was a little bit more lengthened before they came to their final decision and the final settlement than it usually is. So we just got the numbers from them. And it does take some time for us to understand the numbers, and then certainly it takes time to correctly calculate the increase, and most importantly, to put it into the billing system properly and make sure the billing system is tested and working, because certainly the worst thing we want is to have the incorrect bills go to our customers. And because of this, we are not able to implement the pass-through on October 1st, unfortunately. But we do think we will be able to do it by November 1st. There on the slide, you can see the amounts of increase that we calculate will be passed through due to this change in our rates. About $8 million, just somewhat over $8 million, which may sound like a lot, but really when you look at it as a percentage of our retail revenue, it's just about 1 1/3 of a percent. And then when you do all the math for implementing it in November and going back and forth, the final magical number of being passed through will be about 1.398, so just under that 1.4 amount. Now that amount will vary just a little bit class from class, because we do pass it through, as is suggested in our language here, through the allocators from the cost of service model. That's what I was doing yesterday, in fact, working on that. So we don't think it will be very, very different for those class level impacts from the system average, but they will be not exactly that wonderful three decimal pointed percentage number. And we are trying to get this to you promptly so that we can recover the costs as close to the beginning of the BPA fiscal year as we can. So we will hopefully, again, knocking on the knotwood here, get that to you on October 2nd for a public hearing and your review so that we can get it implemented by November 1st. And then we have here is the appendix. I can certainly go through it, or you can read it on your own, exactly what changed and how the math works out for those percents that you saw earlier in the presentation. So do you have any questions?
When this comes back to us, do we typically then see a dollar amount or a cents amount in terms of what the customer will see on their bills? Does that come back?
Since I was not here last time, I can't tell you what's typical, but certainly that I can take that back as feedback for myself.
Well,
to work on
that. My fellow commissioners, haven't we typically received that?
I think so. It'd be a great time for us to look at that graphic of how we stack up for other utilities.
Well, that
sort of
is
the before and after too.
There's a 1.4% here. How does the customer.
Yeah, what does that mean for the customer?
To the customer, what it means is the bill.
Yes, certainly. We can definitely go through that on October 2nd.
I guess the other question is, do we make these as a percentage adjustment, or do we adjust our fixed rate? We're trying to totally increase our fixed rate. I guess we'll have that conversation.
No, they're separated. I think hardly not separate.
So you're saying when we actually do the rate design, are we going to put this in the energy charge, or are we going to put this in the customer charge? That's the question I'm hearing.
Exactly, because I think the customer charge is below where our goal is for it to be. I know this is an energy charge related item, that's what I'm asking.
Yes, the initial thought would be to put it in the energy charge, because it is an energy charge related item. We can certainly, and I can discuss that more fully on October 2nd.
I would say that the intent of the board at the time was to separate them.
Mm-hmm. I would say that although they couldn't be here today, Jason Siskowski, Peter Downer, and Garrison are available if you have any questions. They're available online.
I just want to clarify that the board's intent, I thought at one time, was not to merge those, was to keep them separate, because one is a generation supply and the other is the cost of doing business. Is that?
Yes, so generally power supply costs are put in either energy or, for the larger commercial classes, the demand charge. So the kilowatt hour or the kilowatt charge. And that's sort of what, you know, where my initial instincts would be to put in it. Now, I know that there's, you know, as the commissioner said, we're working on rate design, how much we want to put in. There's, you know, there's other issues in rate design, but there's stability and all that stuff. So certainly we have other choices and levers we can pull. But the initial thought would be to put, if not all, then the majority of it in the energy charge, and the rest of it, you know, in energy charge.
I'm confused. Am I the only one that's confused?
We talked about this before, because I brought it up before. And I don't know that when we put through the fixed rate charge a few years ago, we specifically said that we would always do it this way.
That could well be.
I'm not really sure. I just know that we're trying to, it seems like we're trying to get our base charge up to where we want it to be, and to where it's appropriate. And we've talked about before how rate increases really go to.
Yes.
And I realize this is a specific rate increase, and so I don't have a strong feeling either way. I'm just trying to understand what we're thinking.
But yes, so I didn't, my predecessor didn't leave me with any particular instructions about this. I'm sorry, Commissioner Olson, did I interrupt you?
Oh, no.
Okay.
I'm getting
ready. Yes, so this is a good question, a question of rate design. And the question of, yes, you can always implement a rate design of some amount. You can collect different dollars from customer charge or from an energy charge, the same amount of dollars. And there would be one school of thought that would say we should apply this percentage to all elements of the rate. So we just bring everything up, you know, 1.4%.
So
there would be another school of thought that would say, well, this is a more of a power supply. Well, you can actually make the argument both ways. This is the joy of being an economist. You can make the argument both ways. There's a saying in economics that you could lay all economists end to end and they would not come to a conclusion. So there would be an argument that since this is, that BPA is a power supply issue, we should put that all in our energy charges or in our energy and demand charges for the customer charges. And then there's another argument that would say that the BPA contract is a take or pay contract, so it's a fixed sort of thing we have to pay, and so we should put it in the customer charge. So we can make all the arguments, and there's then becomes a policy question of what is best rate design for the utility.
So this is Peter Downhauer here, Senior Manager of Rates, Economics, and Energy Risk Management. Just wanted to chime in here and point out that we will have a couple of weeks here to come back to you with a recommendation here. And I think what we're trying to do is be consistent with what we've done in the past and follow our rate design principles. There are, like Christina said, different ways we can go about this. And I think what we want to do is just keep it consistent and as straightforward as possible. This is something that we've seen in the past, the BPA passed through in past years. So we can refer back to how we handled that. We're going to see other BPA pass-throughs coming through. We just want to have a consistent approach to the way we implement it and what exactly the way we allocate it. So we'll do that review and make sure we come back with a solid recommendation on what we think's best here. I hope that helps.
Do you have any other questions or comments, Commissioner? I look forward to the next report. I great presentation. And I, but I'm sitting here with history and the reason why it was set up this way. That doesn't mean it always needs to be this way. But I look forward to hearing. Is that coming to us this year?
Yes, so we will be coming in October.
October, okay.
October 2nd there for the public hearing and the commission. And then if you like what we show you, then we'll go forward for the November 1st implementation date. Now, if you would like us to do some more work and you with that, obviously that will delay the implementation date, but we certainly want to be responsive to your concerns.
Well, I may be speaking on something that's a non-issue, but when I heard mingling, it's not consistent, but I thought the original intent, but I don't want to hold things up.
Well, this is not
belaboring, because the reason it was separated was because combined, it really is, you pay Bonneville what you pay Bonneville. Mm-hmm. And what it did was then it the rate becomes, if it's one rate, it becomes larger. And then what that did was we had to reduce on the distribution, on rather the business side, which put pressure on that. And so that was one of the initial thoughts.
Yeah, and I guess since I've been here, I don't think we've had a lot of pass-throughs since we adopted the new rate design.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess you could argue transmission is 0.03%. You could argue that transmission might be a fixed cost,
mm-hmm.
and power isn't. So I'm sorry if I derailed this.
Well, I'm not asking,
subject, but
as long as they're coming forward with, you know, mm-hmm. and something consistent with
yeah.
what I thought the original intent was.
Yeah.
Because putting them together balloons that
yeah,
rate.
Yes, yes.
And then what was happening was you shortchanged the cost of doing business to
yeah.
keep the rate down.
This is one of the questions that I think perhaps was inevitable to come up because we have the new rate design and before when it's all energy charge, then there's no option. But now that there are different portions, then there's more decisions.
Okay.
I just have one more question. Is the residential exchange going to change? Is it going to go up or down or go away? Or
yes, yes.
Is it going to counteract this?
It will not counteract this. I think it changed. I think it was 1/1000th of a or 5/1000th of a cent or some tiny, teeny tiny number. I just remember. I don't remember exactly what that was. I can look it up. We have done that math, but it was an infinitesimal change.
Thank you.
Appreciate all your work on this.
Oh, Peter has saved me with Teams. It is a point, let's see, so that's 0.0064. The new residential exchange rate will be 0.0064 cents. So not very much, sadly.
So you were right when you said it's infinitesimal.
Yes.
Sorry. Christina, thank you for all your work on this. It's phenomenal.
You're welcome.
Really great. Yeah. I'm glad we have you.
I think Garrison's trying to jump in as well.
Hey, this is Garrison coming through the ceiling speakers here. I'm the senior manager of power supply. Just in case this is helpful for folks, you know, maybe just to push it up a higher level here, it's really just a cost recovery issue for us. And so, you know, we're seeing these incremental costs come through from Bonneville, and just our standing practice has been that when those come through, we want to, you know, isolate those and make sure that we have a process for cost recovery there. We did have a small pass-through in the last rate case as well. So, you know, this is just really kind of following those same procedures there.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Pearson.
Thank you, Maureen. Thank you, Christina. Appreciate that. That concludes our presentations for this morning, commissioners.
Great. It is now 10:53, and the meeting is recessed. The regular meeting, well, we can be here in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m.